following program is a presentation of the FlyPod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
Welcome, everybody. You're listening to theflypod.com. I'm your host, Gary Puckett, and we're coming to you exclusively through the high-tech magic of our new media program feeds on www.theflypod.com. The FlyPod Network broadcasts daily to the United States, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. We are your source for local world time-shifted MP3 audio programs and are thrilled to be unzipping the exciting world of new media podcasting. My guest on today's show is Dr. Michael Greger, MD. He is the Director of Public Health and Animal Agriculture for the Humane Society of the United States, located in Washington, D.C. He is a knowledgeable expert on the topic of bird flu, and his book, titled Bird Flu, A Virus of Our Own Hatching, just came out about 5 months ago and is quite a piece. It's a 465-page book on both the dangers and causes of bird flu. Dr. Greger, welcome to theflypod.com.
Glad to be here.
So, what is bird flu in general? And if you would, tell me about the new strain called H5N1.
Avian influenza has existed for millions of years as a harmless intestinal waterborne virus of aquatic birds like ducks. But under extreme conditions, some of these viruses can mutate into not only an airborne form, but a human form, thereby causing not only the regular seasonal human flu, but also, every few decades, a pandemic flu which spreads around the world and potentially can infect millions of people. The concern about this new strain, H5N1, appeared about 10 years ago in Hong Kong. It's since spread around half the world, killed hundreds of millions of birds, but only a handful of people. The concern, though, is that the mortality rate of this particular flu virus is really off the charts. Nothing like we've ever seen before. Currently, the human case mortality rate is about 70%. We don't even get a coin toss as to whether or not we live through this disease. Now, it's only infected about 300 people, only killed about 160 or so people. But the concern is, if this virus were to mutate into a human form, into a form easily transmissible from one person to another, thereby triggering the next pandemic, it could lead to a truly catastrophic situation.
What are the chances of that mutation taking place?
Well, we know another pandemic is inevitable, but we don't know when it'll strike, and we don't know how bad it will be. But with this unprecedented spread of this truly unprecedented flu virus, public health authorities around the world are urging their citizenry to really make practical, concrete measures to mediate the impact of the next pandemic within their families, within their communities.
Well, I want to ask you this next question because leading up to today's show, I had a lot of people ask me this when they found out that you were going to be a guest on my show. So I suppose it's somewhat of a common question. Is bird flu spread in any way by migratory birds, or is it pretty much confined to commercially raised flocks of chickens or other types of birds?
Well, typically, migratory birds have been the scapegoat throughout this last decade where the virus has spread quite far out of its origin in South China into Africa, into England, all throughout Europe, and the rest of Asia. And the original thought was that it was indeed these migratory birds, but more and more evidence is accumulating. In fact, last year, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, the world's leading agriculture authority, concluded in a consensus document that indeed it really did seem to be the commercial trade in poultry and birds and bird products that seemed to be primarily to blame for spreading this disease, although migratory birds may play a small role.
Is it accurate to say that this is an, I mean, aside from the birds flying, okay, is this an airborne virus, or does a person have to physically come in contact with an infected host?
Well, right now, the people that are getting infected, the very, very few people that have become infected, have really had quite kind of intimate contact, whether they're drinking raw duck blood pudding or they were involved in cockfighting and, you know, kind of resuscitating their fighting cocks by, you know, mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. These kind of unusual very intimate contacts with infected birds is what's led to this first handful of human deaths. That's not what primarily we're concerned about. We're not concerned that people are going to get it from birds. Again, hundreds of millions of birds have died. Thousands of people were potentially came in contact with infected birds, but again, very few people have died. This virus is not good at spreading from birds to people. Forget people to people. The concern, though, from what we know in the past, is that the influenza viruses have the ability to mutate, to change rapidly, and if this flu were to go human, then birds really would be out of the picture. People could no longer say, well, look, I don't have contact with infected birds. I don't have to worry about this bird flu. Well, that's really kind of a misconception. True, most of us don't have to worry about bird flu, but bird flu can turn into pandemic flu, and everyone needs to be concerned about that because you get pandemic flu just like you get the regular flu from other people, from being in a confined, enclosed space with people coughing or touching a contaminated object like a doorknob and then touching one's face without properly hand washing. And then really birds are out of the picture, and we could really have a devastating flu pandemic like the last time that bird flu jumped from birds to people. See, influenza has a track record. It's done it before, and we're afraid it's going to do it again. Back in 1918, a bird flu virus jumped species into humans and became the worst plague in human history, killing between 50 and 100 million people around the globe. Were concerned that H5N1 might have the capacity to do something like that as well.
If I hear what you're saying there on this, because I was going to ask you if there's ever been a confirmed case of bird flu in the United States, when in reality, if you look back at 1918, I suppose there has been.
Well, there was certainly pandemic flu. In fact, a quarter of all Americans fell ill, probably killed about 500,000 Americans. A similar pandemic today, what the CDC would describe as a Category 5 pandemic today, estimated to kill about 3 million Americans. We have had actually bird flu here in the United States. I mean, the biggest outbreak of bird flu before H5N1 in Hong Kong was actually in Pennsylvania. In the 1983-84, 17 million birds dead, spread to five states, probably the costliest disease, animal disease eradication in U.S. history. So there have been big bird flu outbreaks here in North America, in 2004 in Canada as well, but very few people have become infected. No one has died, thankfully. But again, every time this kind of rears its ugly head, the more birds it infects, the more people it infects, the greater the chances, kind of more spins it has at pandemic roulette. And so we really need to take a step back and say, well, wait a second, how is this virus mutating into these highly pathogenic, dangerous forms? And is there anything we can do to kind of prevent the emergence of these viruses in the first place?
Well, whenever a stock lot of commercially produced chickens, chicken farm, if you will, is found to have bird flu infection, they immediately kill the entire flock of birds. What do they do with the remains? Do they have to be incinerated, or what kills the virus?
Well, the virus is actually very quite sensitive to heat. Again, it really evolved in migratory aquatic birds who, winter in those ice-cold Canadian lakes. The virus likes the cold. In fact, that's why, one of the reasons why the human flu comes back every winter, at least in the Northern Hemisphere. It's because the virus really does seem to exist, thrive in cold environments. And so very sensitive to heat, so proper cooking utterly destroys this virus. And similarly, you can take infected bird carcasses, you can actually compost them, probably the most environmentally sound method. You can actually compost them, and just the heat from the bacterial decomposition is actually enough to destroy the virus.
Interesting. Well, is this flu, would it be mostly deadly to older people? I mean, wouldn't young people with healthy immune systems be somewhat at a lower risk?
Well, certainly for the regular seasonal flu, that's the case. Up to 60 million Americans come down with the flu every year. It may kill as many as 30,000 Americans every year, but it's typically the elderly, the infirm, and very small children. But some pandemic strains are different. So, for example, back in 1918, the leading category of death was age 20 to 34, really the most robust members of our society.
Sure.
And similarly, H5N1 seems to be doing the same thing. The average age of death of these 162 so cases is 20 years of age. It's killing young people. And now that we actually have the 1918 virus to study in a very kind of in a Jurassic Park type scientific expedition into the permafrost of Alaska, we discovered a corpse buried frozen since 1918, got some tissue, lung tissue samples, we're actually able to recreate, resurrect the 1918 virus to study, and we have this H5N1 virus, which we can study readily. And we think what's happening is this virus, both these viruses, are triggering what's called a cytokine storm. Basically, they're triggering over-exuberant immune reaction. So actually, it's kind of tricking your body to attack your own lungs. So it's kind of an autoimmune reaction, which is good for the virus because you have this kind of violent hacking cough, which may spread the virus. Unfortunately, not so good for us. And so, ironically, it's the people with the strongest immune systems, the most robust immune systems, who are particularly vulnerable. After age 40 or so, your immune system starts to decline. And so that may be one reason why these young people are dying, these young, healthy people. On autopsy, the victims of this H5N1 bird flu, actually, their lungs are sterile. Your body was successful in destroying the virus, but in kind of burning down the village in order to save it, unfortunately, you don't make it through that process.
Well, what are the symptoms of bird flu in chickens, for example? Can you easily tell that a chicken in a flock has the disease just by looking at the bird?
Well, these highly pathogenic versions are very difficult to miss. In fact, many of these strains have 100% morbidity, 100% mortality, meaning all the birds get sick, all the birds die. And it can happen in as short as 24 hours. So
wow.
Some contract grower for broilers or meat-type chickens can literally get up and see half their flock dying. And it is really quite a devastating illness in these birds. It's been dubbed what they call chicken Ebola because basically they start bleeding from their bodily orifices and almost kind of liquefies their internal organs. H5N1 is really kind of extreme in that regard in that it doesn't limit itself to the lungs. Most flu viruses limit themselves to the lungs, but H5N1 can spread through the bloodstream to other organs. In fact, a number of children in Asia came in with bird flu infection without respiratory symptoms at all. They came in a coma, basically a coma and diarrhea, and the virus had infected their brains. Yet another reason why this H5N1 may be so deadly in people and deadly in birds as well.
So when a human being comes in because they're suffering from certain symptoms, to the physicians treating them, do they appear to have flu-like symptoms or not necessarily?
Well, unfortunately, not necessarily with this H5N1 strain, but they do typically have this really kind of virulent flu-like illness, typically with the muscle aches, high fever, and often cough as well. But again, it seems to be kind of mixing it up and having these unusual symptom presentations. If it were to mutate into a human pandemic flu, we would expect it, like the flu of 1918, to have this flu-like presentation with a muscle aches, high fever, etc., where you just, you know, feel like you can't get out of bed, but instead of feeling better after 3 to 5 days like regular flu, like back in 1918, what happened to millions of people around the world is that they just got progressively worse.
We hear the word pandemic used a lot when the topic of bird flu comes up, but define a pandemic for me. What does that exactly mean?
A pandemic, unlike other natural disasters or unnatural disasters, whether it be a terrorism attack or an earthquake or a hurricane, are typically relatively confined in both space and time. In contrast, a pandemic, by definition, is a global, worldwide outbreak of disease. So epidemic comes from the roots epidemos, meaning upon the people. Pandemic means kind of upon all the people. And indeed, flu pandemics in the past have infected up to half of the world's population. And so even if the virus has a minuscule mortality rate, 1 to 2%, it can be devastating in terms of the number of human deaths and cases.
Well, has an effective vaccine been developed?
Unfortunately, we cannot produce a pandemic vaccine until we actually have the pandemic virus. There are being attempts right now. In fact, I'm involved in one such study here at the National Institutes of Health in D.C., we are making vaccines to the current bird flu virus, thinking that should it mutate into a human form, it'll look close enough to the bird form that there'll be some kind of cross-reactivity. But just like every year we have to make up a new human flu vaccine to match the current strain,
right.
Similarly, we really have to nail it down. And so we are making a gamble that vaccines against the current bird flu will work against a potential future human flu, but it's possible that there just simply won't be enough cross-immunity, enough cross-reactivity, and that there won't be the protection that we're hoping for. However, once a pandemic does strike, by 2012, we should have enough vaccine production capacity in this country to essentially vaccinate all Americans 6 months after a pandemic strikes. Well, so we have a long way to go. The question falls back to, well, what can one do during those first 6 months? Even if it doesn't strike till 2012, we'll be vulnerable for 6 months. And just last month, the federal government released their guidelines for community to mitigate the impact of the pandemic during those first vulnerable months.
Well, are there certain patterns of behavior or practice that can contribute or increase a person's chance of contracting this? I mean, if you are a world traveler, for example, does this put you more at risk?
Well, during a pandemic, the only really criteria is to come in contact with an infected person or a potentially infected person. And people with influenza, particularly children, can be infectious for a day or days before they start showing symptoms. So they look perfectly fine, they feel perfectly fine, but maybe exhaling virus with every breath. That's why it's very difficult to contain, to quarantine influenza, unlike a disease like SARS. SARS, typically, you showed symptoms and then became infectious. So you could set up fever monitors at airports. You know, you could quarantine people that were coughing, and we stopped it. We stopped SARS dead. Unfortunately, not so with influenza, because you become infectious before you actually start showing symptoms. So the strategy, as developed by the Department of Health and Human Services, is what's called voluntary home quarantine, or sheltering in place. Basically, Americans will be asked to kind of isolate themselves and their families in their homes until the danger passes. Although a pandemic may last 12 to 18 months, it comes in waves, and in any particular locale only may last a few weeks. And so that's why the CDC recommends that all Americans right now have weeks of essential goods, you know, food, water, etc., stockpiled such that they can effectively self-quarantine during a pandemic situation.
Well, the title of your book, a serious subject, but I still thought the title was quite clever, Bird Flu, A Virus of Our Own Hatching, infers we human beings have caused all of this. Can you explain why you titled the book the way you did?
The reason I wrote this book, I mean, I did much of my postgraduate medical work at an AIDS hospital up in Boston, and, you know, I just kept thinking on the wards, you know, when I was growing up, I mean, there's no such thing as HIV/AIDS. And then we had SARS, mad cow disease, bird flu. From where do emerging diseases emerge? I mean, that's really what started me down this path, and particularly in light of H5N1. And what I discovered in my research is that in the last 30 years, more than 30 new diseases have emerged, something really unheard of in the annals of medicine. Something is changing recently, and the question is, well, what's happened in recent years to kind of bring this all upon us? And unfortunately, I think what humanity is doing to the natural world may very well play a role. In terms of H5N1, you know, chickens used to peck around the barnyard, but now we cram tens of thousands of birds into these filthy football field-sized sheds to lie beak-to-beak in their own waste, a veritable breeding ground for disease. And in fact, these kind of unhygienic, stressful, crowded conditions is thought to what led to the transformation of this harmless duck virus into this highly pathogenic chicken virus, which then was able to become potentially much more dangerous to human beings as well on a mass scale. And so I talk about the industrialization, the intensification of the poultry industry, really worldwide, particularly in Southeast Asia, just very recently, which seems to lead to this really exponential increase in the number of emergences of these highly pathogenic flu viruses, And unless we do something, unless we really move away from that industrial model, I'm afraid if H5N1 doesn't go pandemic, then another one of these new highly pathogenic flu viruses will.
The model that you're referring to, does that involve turkey production as well as chickens?
Indeed. Just last month, the bird flu hit the poultry population in Britain for the first time. And where did it hit? It hit in the largest turkey producer in Europe,
okay.
This farm which had 160,000 turkeys. And if you think of a turkey, and how do you fit 160,000 turkeys on one farm? Well, you do it by confining them in these massive warehouse-like buildings. And basically, they're living in their own waste. There's a lack of adequate ventilation. There's no sunlight. And some of the UV rays in sunlight are actually quite effective in destroying influenza. The waste is decomposing, releasing ammonia, burning their respiratory tracts, which predisposes them to respiratory infection in the first place. So there's this kind of unhygienic, stressful, overcrowded conditions that really does seem to facilitate this mutation, this transformation from low-path or harmless to highly pathogenic, dangerous types of virus. But, you know, along with human culpability comes hope. I mean, if changes in human behavior can cause new plagues, well, then changes in human behavior may prevent them in the future.
Do you see any signs that the poultry industry on their own is making any move towards change in the way they configure their operations as it relates to this high concentration of birds?
Unfortunately, we haven't seen any kind of voluntary movement in that direction. In fact, quite the reverse. I mean, they're kind of expanding this so-called Tysonization of the developing world, whether it's Brazil, whether it's Africa, whether it's Southeast Asia. They're really kind of expanding and taking it around the world. And so the situation, unfortunately, seems to be getting worse and better and may explain the fact why just in recent years there's been so many human infections with bird flu viruses, not just H5N1, but four other chicken flu viruses. Again, something really unheard of in recent years, as well as the emergence of all these highly pathogenic strains. And they've all arisen in these kind of intensive environments, whether it was in the Netherlands, or whether it's in Pennsylvania or Canada or Chile or Pakistan, Italy, all these emergences of these highly pathogenic flu viruses all came in these kind of intensive factory farm environments. And, you know, I think it's maybe part of human psychology. It's just you don't shore up the levees until after the disaster. But in a post-pandemic world, we may very well see a massive change within the poultry industry.
What would you suggest to the average person that they do to prepare or be aware of this pandemic you describe? What can they do to be as best prepared as possible?
Well, the CDC has set up an excellent pandemic preparedness website, pandemicflu.gov, so that's pandemicflu.gov, and on there are really simple planning checklists for schools, businesses, places of worship, all the way down to individual and family preparation. And so you can go through and you just go down the checklist. The concentration really is, again, on stockpiling weeks of essential supplies. So it says, you know, do you have peanut butter? Check. Do you have, you know, and you kind of go down this list, because the primary strategy during a pandemic is not get infected in the first place. We don't have enough ventilators. We don't have enough antiviral drugs like this Tamiflu. We're not going to have a vaccine in the first few months. And so what we can do is just try not to get infected in the first place. And the way we do that is stay away from potentially infected persons. But, you know, if you have to, you know, go out to the corner store to buy toilet paper or something, during a pandemic, you may be bringing back to your family more than just groceries.
Very interesting. Well, Dr. Greger, Michael, if I may, I want to thank you for coming on to flypod.com and sharing this information with us. And I want you to make me a promise that you'll come back on my show as new information develops on this killer virus.
I would be happy to.
Well, this wraps up our show. For information on how to obtain a copy of Dr. Greger's book, Bird Flu, A Virus of Our Own Hatching, visit the website www.birdflubook.com. Until next time, I'm your host, Gary Puckett, coming free and clear to your iPod or MP3 player through our new media program feeds on www.theflypod.com. If you have any comments or ideas you'd like to share with us, grab your cell phone and call our listener comment line at 206-337-1716. Again, that's 206-337-1716. Tell your friends about theflypod.com, and thanks for listening.